Fastamai, hello and welcome to this edition of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. Are there too many small charities on the Isle of Man, with the third sector facing challenges like new regulations, bank charges and the impact of COVID? This week on Agenda, we find out where the Council of Voluntary Organisations sees the future for charities on the island. As well as that, we find out how links are being made with Manx Care and about a conference on the third sector due later this year. In 2019, seven charities ceased operating, three of which merged with others to continue going. Last year, that figure increased to 16, four of which joined up with other organisations. Is that an early sign of the impact of new charities regulations and their impact on smaller organisations? It's a question I put to the Vice Chair of the Council of Voluntary Organisations, David Gorn.
I believe that we have a lot of challenges, but at the same time, we have a lot of exciting opportunities. And I think how we react and what we do in the next few months could determine how the third sector in the island operates for years to come. And I think it's necessary perhaps to define what we mean by third sector, because Laurie Hooper in the Tynwald debate mentioned that people tend to assume we're talking about charities. Well, when we talk about third sector, we are embracing a whole raft of things, where including registered charities, we're including community groups, faith groups, sports groups. So it's any organisation which is for the benefit of the community, but is not for profit. And you know, it is wider than just talking about registered charities.
16 charities closed last year, four of which merged with other charities. Is this all about now, with the burdens of the charities bill and other changes, this is about smaller charities maybe folding into bigger charities so they can keep going and there is that economy of scale?
I think this is something we've got to look at, because we do have a lot of charities pursuing very similar goals. And you're absolutely right that obviously the COVID situation has caused a reduction of income. The charity shops have by and large been closed, so the organisations that are relying on income from the shops have suffered. Other charities have also suffered because fundraising events have not taken place, but at the same time expenditure has not really changed. I know there's been support from the government schemes to those charities who actually employ people, but I think what we've found is that rather than reduce the number of hours people are working, the number of hours have increased, the number of hours being given by volunteers has increased, and I think to some extent the demands being placed on charities have changed as well. And I think if we look at if we compare the first lockdown to the later lockdowns, in the first lockdown, people were looking for support with shopping, getting the necessities of life in, and that was very well responded to. But I think following that, people got realised that charities are doing this, but also a number of commercial organisations geared themselves up and have played a fantastic role in making sure people are, if you like, fed and watered. So I think what we've seen in the second and third lockdown is people are much more concerned about isolation, loneliness, depression, because there's been a lot less certainty than there was in the first lockdown. I think people in the first lockdown saw that it was for a set period, it was going to finish after that. But this time it's been a lot more uncertain for a whole variety of reasons. We've had different strains coming in, and I think that has placed a different reliance on charities. And certainly, you know, we've got other charities who deal with people with long-term health conditions who are being inundated with, well, what's happening with my operation? What's happening with my procedure? So I think the landscape is changing, and I think you're absolutely right. It's like anything else. We do have to look at how we sustain the number of charities that we've got, even if it's just a question of creating one administration facility that perhaps we might have individual charities that retain their own name, but perhaps we provide one building which they can operate from, one computer system which they can share, which is obviously restricted to their own area. And I think those are the sort of things we need to look at, because I don't think we can continue to support the number of charities we've got at the moment.
And is that because of new burdens of the charities bill because of that loss of income? Is that why this sort of patchwork of smaller charities might not be sustainable going forward?
It's a combination of things. I think it's all of those, basically. Obviously, the new charity regulations have caused charities to look at the way they operate. Are we operating within our constitution? Perhaps people have suddenly realised the responsibilities which the trustees are holding, and that is now being more enforced. I don't think it's the regulations themselves that are an issue, and it's the fact that they are now being complied with more effectively than they were previously, and that is causing people to take a look at the way they operate, and of course. We'll talk about bank charges, but we've also got the question of audit fees, which are quite significant.
And this disproportionately affects the smaller charities because I'm assuming the bigger ones are more resourced and geared up to be able to deal with these requirements.
Yes, we've got. I think when we were doing the regulations, we discovered that something around 40% of charities have a turnover of £5,000 or less. And they are what I call the kitchen table charities. They're run purely by volunteers from their own home. Those volunteers don't get paid. And in fact, most of them pay the telephone bill. They pay the postage. All the costs of the charity are more or less met by the individual. So what they get is applied directly for the benefit of their members. And yes, these are the ones that we need to look at. And I think if I had one area of Ewan Watterson's motion, which I felt wasn't right, was that he said that all charities should have free banking. Now, we have the vast majority of charities on the Isle of Man are probably £50,000 or less income. But obviously, we do have some big charities, and they are effectively businesses. And I would expect them to negotiate their bank charges in the same way as any other business would. Mm-hmm. So whilst I'm in agreement with smaller charities, I think, you know, we need to be... We can't take the view that every charity is free, because we have some big ones who are very professional and have to be very professional. Mm. They have to have the same level of staffing. They have to have the same level of compliance as government departments. But I think that the ones that are concerning are the smaller ones who are being hit. Mm. If you don't have to have an audit, then if your turnover is less than 250,000, then that's fine. You have an independent examination which can be probably done for a few hundred pound. But once you get into the audit stakes, you're talking in terms of about £5,000.
We'll talk more widely on that, the banking charges issue particularly in just a moment. I did want to ask you about this sort of talking about the future direction, perhaps more shared administration, shared buildings, shared costs in a lot of areas between these small charities. Isn't the beauty of what the Isle of Man has had with charities is that there are so many single issue charities, small charities? And are you concerned that with the burdens that we now have and the changes, that might go and we might become like the UK and we won't have those single issue smaller charities?
I think that is a concern, and that really is why I would like to see an infrastructure being provided which would enable those smaller charities to continue independently, to continue the work that they're doing, but being free to concentrate on that aspect and not having perhaps to worry about having to raise funds for buildings. But as I say, most of them are from the kitchen table anyway. But what happens when the owner of the kitchen table is no longer involved in the charity? So I think it is absolutely imperative that we provide some sort of backup and some sort of integrated service that will enable those small charities to retain their individuality.
Well, you know the sector. Would they sign up to that? Because there is competition among charities. Some want to be helping in one area, some in another, but there is sometimes overlap and competition. Are they up for working together on
this? Well, I think I said to you that we have some exciting challenges and some exciting opportunities, and I think this is one of the opportunities, but it's also a challenge. And I think, you know, the way we need to look at this is that charities must remain independent, but at the same time there is a need to be interdependent. And I think that is something which we need to look at, so that we can show, like any other sector, that we are supporting each other and that we are delivering best value for money. And I think, you know, yes, by all means, we need to retain the small charities because they have a niche market. They support people. And, you know, we have some charities which are peer support groups, where you've got somebody who maybe has a disability or an illness, and they're a bit uncertain. what they need to do, what's the greatest comfort for them, is to pick the phone up and speak to somebody who's been there, who can say, well, actually, don't worry about that. That's quite normal. That is what will happen. Or I've been referred to Mr. So-and-so. Well, that's okay. So that we can give people that confidence. And that also we have shared websites so that people can go on a website and identify which charity they want to deal with, rather than having to perhaps trawl through a whole load. But again, that doesn't take away the independence of the charity. It just means they're more, if you like, they're getting a higher profile through something else. But that is one of the challenges that we have is to actually get people working together and to demonstrate the economies of scale, if you like, but not taking away from them the value of what they do.
A fine balancing
act. They're not subsumed, if you like, by the big one.
That was David Gorn, the Vice Chair of the Council of Voluntary Organisations. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. It's feared new charges introduced by Isle of Man Bank for charity accounts will hit those who benefit from the third sector's work. But after a motion in Tynwald, Treasury is investigating how to develop free banking services for not-for-profit organisations. As a former banker on the Isle of Man, I asked Mr. Gorn for his view on Isle of Man Bank's fee hike.
I feel incredibly sad at the turn of events and the debates which are going on at the moment. Some people might say, well, you would say that, being an ex-Isle of Man banker. But to some extent, and the Isle of Man Bank has said that the number of accounts that they maintain for charities is disproportionate. And that's absolutely right. But I think if we look back historically, the Isle of Man Bank has played a fantastic role in the community and with small charities, community groups, sport groups, etc., where they have actively been the bank in the community. They've offered people these banking facilities. And in fact, it's gone further than that, that they have provided treasurers, secretaries, etc., and on occasions allowed them to do that work within bank time. And I can remember, and I'm sure you can, in recent years where I can think of five or six charity stroke events where the Isle of Man Bank did not just provide a treasurer, but effectively they managed the finances of that organisation, that event, that they seconded staff on the day to help out at gates, collecting cash, etc. They have when we had flag days, they have counted cash for people. So I think, you know, we need to bear in mind the proud record that the bank has had in this field. And this is where I feel very sad that we've now got to this situation. We calculate that the Isle of Man Bank has got something like 80% of the business of charities, and that would equate to round about 300 charities. At the same time, obviously, you have to recognise that the bank is a business, and it has to recoup its costs. But if you look at those costs, and we've done a very rough calculation, that the application of these new charges would produce probably something in the region of £120,000 to £150,000 a year. Now, that's a tremendous amount for the island's charitable sector. But if you look at the social capital, social investment return on that, if you look at some of these small charities who will be now be paying some of the small ones will probably be paying about £300 a year in charges. But if you take the overall figure of maybe £120,000, £150,000, if you convert that into what it's worth to the island community, it's probably worth £500,000. And I'm not saying that the Isle of Man Bank should continue to bear that burden, but can we not get together with the other banks and work out a scheme so that between the four banks on the island who operate charity accounts, we can offer free banking on maybe a tiered basis, so that the load is spread across the banks, and that social investment, that social capital, is maintained. And if we're talking about £30,000 per bank per year, perhaps that is something which they might find palatable.
Well, there is a proposal, of course, in the Manx politics to do with the Treasury going and investigating this issue and ensuring that there is that ability for smaller charities to bank free of charge. Now, who should be paying for this ultimately? I mean, Isle of Man Bank, some might say their community outward-facing days are behind them with some of the recent moves they've made, so they don't appear likely to change their decision on this. Who should step in and provide these facilities then? You've mentioned your four bank proposals. Some people said the post office. Some say government should fund a facility. What do you think is the best way of going about this?
I think this is all in the melting pot. I think we've got to meet with Treasury. We've got to meet with the banks. We've got to consider all the options to see what's available. I don't know what the banks might say. The banks might say, well, yeah, we're prepared to absolve that. And I think what we need to look at there is that in terms of the bank income, they're not actually losing income. What they're losing is the opportunity to earn income. So that instead of getting that income coming in, if you like, in banking terms, that...
Well, how do you feel about charities being targeted as a way of earning money by a bank?
Well, I think you've got to look at the ethics of all this. But on the other hand, there are those who would argue that, you know, charities have to pay for other services. But I think the difference is that banks are seen as being part of the community, an extension of the community. If the banks obviously pick up this tab, then it's the bank shareholders who ultimately will meet the costs. There may well be that we can come to some arrangement where those costs are met. I don't know. There's a whole raft of things, and obviously the debate only took place last week. We will now be meeting with Treasury and with the banks to talk about how we can actually come up with some sort of resolution for this. It may well be, and I know the old gyro bank was mentioned. I don't know in this day and age with all the regulations and requirements how easy that is. We need to look at how we operate. How can we as charities change the way we operate to maybe reduce some of our charges?
Now, Manx Care has come in and become the operational delivery organisation for health services. In the Sir Jonathan Michael report, when he's talking about Manx Care, he does make reference to how the third sector and Manx Care should work together. He wants to encourage that where possible. So anything that Manx Care can't provide, the third sector can. How's it going with Manx Care? Has the third sector had an opportunity to build that relationship or start talking about that relationship?
Yes, I think we talked earlier about the future of charities on the island and the course that we might be steering as we move forward. And I mentioned challenges and opportunities. And obviously, there are challenges and opportunities which have and are presenting themselves in connection with the integration of care services, which has resulted in a wellbeing centre in Peel, which is now being extended to other parts of the island. We have the transformation programme, which is looking at the way in which things are going to be delivered. And then obviously we have Manx Care, who is going to do the delivery. And we are in conversation with all three of those to see how we can work together to achieve this. And obviously, I prefer now to use a word well-being as opposed to health and social care, because if you talk about well-being, it embraces all aspects of government. It embraces housing, it embraces streets, it embraces transport, because there's no point in getting somebody into independent living if they can't get out of the house because the pavement is too high, or the cobbled streets are no good, or the bus service is no good. So I think we need to look at the whole question of well-being and take that as one aspect. But yes, we are talking about this. We've had conversations with the three senior executives of Manx Care, and in fact they are coming to meet the third sector at a CVO meeting on the 11th of May, which is a week on Tuesday, to get to know the sector. And we've talked about how we can put in place a communications package so that we keep in regular contact, that we discuss with each other and debate who is the best to deliver this, because it may not be the best way to do it through the statutory sector. And there are often occasions where the third sector can get to people which the statutory sector can't reach. And an example of that was I was talking to a colleague in Gry who had been dealing with somebody with a specific substance misuse problem, and they'd actually managed to engage and get that person to start coming into contact with medical services. But everybody else had failed. But because they were seen as being a non-judgmental arm, and I think sometimes the third sector is seen as being non-judgmental, whereas rightly or wrongly, there is a different view of the off the statutory sector. Mm. So I think, you know, we've got to work with that. I sat on the advisory panel for the Jonathan Michael report, so we did have quite a lot of input into that, and certainly we the initial signs at the moment are that are encouraging that we will all work together. And as part of the transformation project, there have been various pathway groups to look at how services for different disabilities, different illnesses, conditions, etc., are delivered. So hopefully, if everything's been fed into there, comes out and we all work together. But it's essential that we do work together to achieve this, because whether we get funded by the public through charitable donations, through government by taxation, at the end of the day, we're all funded by the same pool of people. But it is important that we all show that we are delivering the best value for money, that we're not working against each other and thereby creating further costs. Mm. But because often enough, we are the best people to deliver something. On other occasions, it's the statutory sector. So we have some innovative ideas as to how we might move forward on that, how we might put in services. Because at the end of the day, we all want to put the patient first.
Well, how much of an issue is the length of contracts and the surety that gives third sector groups who are providing certain services? I know, just skimming through their report, it was mentioned that sometimes proper commissioning of the third sector services that are available would help a long-term security.
Yeah, this is something which is being addressed. And some organisations have commissioned contracted services from government. Others have been operating on grant aid. Now, grant aid traditionally is from year to year. Now, two or three years ago, we actually did get a commitment from government that they would give 6 months' notice if they weren't going to review a contract. Sorry, if they weren't going to review a grant aid package. But you're absolutely right, because if you are trying to embark upon a new course of action, a new product, for want of a better word, you need to have certainty that you can deliver that product, say, for 2 or 3 years, particularly if you're employing staff. And you can't just say to staff, well, actually, we're going to give you a one-year contract. You need to know that that is going to run for 3 to 5 years. And in the same way, if you're looking to rent a property, then the landlord is looking for more than 1 year. But that is being addressed within the new regime. All grant aids within DHSC have been given notice that as from next year, they will get the grant aid this year, but as from April, May next year, they will stop. So during that period, a different way of either commissioning or funding or obtaining those services will be put in place. So yes, that is being addressed as part of Manx Care, because that has been a major concern as to the certainty of continuing services over a longer period.
We've got so many things that we've just talked about there, so many different issues, banking charges, Manx Care coming in, charities, regulations. It's probably a good time to take stock of what the landscape of charities is like, which is what you're doing.
We will be launching in the next 2 weeks. We would have, like everything else, we would have launched it about 6 months ago, but for COVID. And that is a landscaping exercise to look at where the third sector is, what it contributes to the Manx economy, what each charity is doing, how we can do it better, how we can work better together. The last time we did one of these was 10 years ago, so the time is now right to do it. And we did say when the charity regulation was going through that we would do a landscaping exercise. So this will make us better informed to know what everybody is doing, what people can do, what they want. So to actually determine the value of the sector. Last time we did it, we produced a figure that the actual sector produced about £80 million a year towards the Manx economy, and that we had somewhere in the region of 10,000 volunteers. So we need to update that information. But the whole scenario has changed over those 10 years. So we need to have a new look at that so that we are being guided as how we move forward. And obviously we will share that that information with on an anonymised basis with colleagues in government. We now have the Chief Minister Committee on Community and Engagement. So again, we will be, you know, we'll be talking to them as to how all this might fit together, and how we might ensure that we are seen as one, if you like, a third sector community, embracing everything, so we all know we're all working together.
That was David Gorn, and that's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this edition online via the Manx Radio website or through Spotify as a podcast. But for now, Guru Mayu and goodbye.